And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman on this Thursday. Today we begin with a look at one of South Florida's treasures, Biscayne National Park. It was created in 1968, and 95% of its area is aquatic. With us is the park's superintendent. He's Brian Carlstrom, and he'll update us on the park status and upcoming public sessions about the park's plans and environmental impacts and its future. Welcome to you, Brian Carlstrom, freshly driven in from Homestead.
Thank you, Joseph.
And hi, Brian. Great to have you.
It's good to be here.
So many people, and I number among them, may not know that Biscayne National Park is one of the largest marine parks in the U.S. Tell us more about the park and its history.
Well, the park was created in 1968, largely through an upswing from the public that was concerned about potential industrial development in the area where the park was created. And it's really intriguing in that it protects four different ecosystems. It's got the coastal mangroves, the bay itself with all the seagrass meadows, the tropical hammock hardwoods on the islands that are the 42 keys that are the northernmost portion of the Florida Keys are in the park. And in the coral reef itself, we've got about 5,000 patch reefs within the park. So the
What's a patch reef?
It's just a small... Right. A lot of people, when they hear of a reef, they think of the long, drawn-out, kind of linear features. These are more patches that are more round in shape or a little oblong, but these aren't necessarily connected. They're patches of coral reef out beyond the island.
And the fish live among them?
Yes, they do.
And so you've been the superintendent for almost a year now. Have you implemented any changes yet?
Not specifically. We're in the midst of trying to finish up our general management plan and just got word that we're going to be moving ahead with our fisheries management plan last week. The park is an amazing place. It's there for the citizens of Miami to enjoy, the citizens of the country to enjoy, really the citizens of the world. It's one of 401 units that make up the entire national park system. And Biscayne is so unique in the marine resources that it's protecting.
Tell me about the park and the impact that it shares with being nestled with a nearby nuclear plant and also Mount Trashmore.
Yes, Biscayne does have some interesting neighbors. We're the only national park with a nuclear power plant adjacent to us. We are working with FPL on two new proposed reactors that are considered to being built on that site, trying to minimize that impact on the park. And Mount Trashmore is one of our neighbors as well.
It's one of my favorite spots.
It's the highest spot in Miami. Mount Trashmore specifically, we really don't have major issues with them right now, but we do work with them very closely, and I know there's a canal around the perimeter of it that helps to isolate some of the effluent that may be leaching off of that.
How will you minimize the impact of the nuclear plants if they're built?
We're working with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission hand in hand in the environmental impact statement that's being developed for those two new proposed reactors. There'll be mitigations that will be put into place that will be defined within that plan.
Could you cover some of these public meetings that you've scheduled? Coral Gables, Homestead, one other place, and they start, that would be Monday, December 9th.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. The park right now is in the midst of reviewing its supplemental draft environmental impact statement for its general management plan. That's a planning effort that's been underway for 10 years. Back in 2011, we released the original draft general management plan, and we got some pretty significant comments from cooperating agencies and some marine groups that were concerned about how limiting it was to access specifically for fishing. And our supplemental draft environmental impact statement has got two new alternatives that look at ways we can allow for some access but still preserve the resource.
So you kind of backed off in some respect. And what about commercial fishing?
Commercial fishing in the park has occurred since it was created. The fisheries management plan, which is going to be moving ahead, will eventually eliminate any commercial fishing within the park.
So it'll just be recreational?
Just be recreational fishing. And with the proposed alternative six, as it's known, that the fishing will be, some of the fishing within the park will be restricted within a special recreation zone to help manage the reef so that it can be preserved in better condition than it currently is.
What's the most threatened species of fish in the park?
You know, a lot of the grouper species have been in decline for a long time.
They live a long time, right?
They do, and their life cycle is very long, and it takes quite a while for them to reach a sexually mature age.
How long is long?
You know, I've seen some reports. They can, you know, the high end are not 30 years, maybe, for some of the larger species. They're very long-lived fish.
If you'd like to join in the conversation, we're speaking with Brian Carlstrom. He's the superintendent of Biscayne National Park. Questions or comments, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or you can email radio@wlrn.org. I was wondering how important the public's feedback is in deciding any plans for the park.
That's absolutely critical. That's what the meetings are being held for next week. The National Park Service, like all federal agencies, when there's any major federal action that's going to take place, we conform with the National Environmental Policy Act. By policy, each of our general management plans includes an environmental impact statement. The plan is currently out for public review through February 2nd. And next week, we will have meetings where the public can provide their comments on December 9th at the University of Miami in Coral Gables, Tuesday, December 10th at Florida City's City Hall, and December 11th down in Key Largo at the Holiday Inn.
And what time are they?
They all go from 6 to 9 o'clock.
Okay.
6 to 6:30 will be kind of an open house format. We'll have a lot of posters available. We'll have a lot of people from the park staff and the planning team to help answer questions and provide clarification on what the plan is about.
And we'll also have links to those meetings at the WLRN website.
Do you have a website?
Yes, we do.
What is that?
You can get to it from... www.nps.gov/BISC. And then if you go from there on the left-hand tabs, there's park management.
Say it again.
And you can also just go to the Topical Currents Facebook page. We'll have links.
That's probably the easiest way to get there. But it's www.nps.gov/BISC.
Now, if I'm a fisherman and I'm kind of rankled that I don't have much access to be able to fish in the park, and I go to one of these meetings and I get the microphone, do I really have any effect on policy?
Sure. Public is welcome to comment. And we look at all those comments once they come in for anything that's of a substantive nature, and we take those into consideration as we move towards a final environmental impact statement. And that's what's gotten us to a supplemental draft. That's what we heard loud and clear from the draft plan that was put together in 2011. Now, the park, the way it's currently managed, is regulated by the state of Florida with the regulations that are in place by the state. Our rangers enforce those along with FWC.
Fish and Wildlife.
Fish and Wildlife Gate, yes. Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission, yes.
How has the park been affected by environmental factors, global, you know, climate change, or in particular the coral reefs?
Or rising seas?
The coral reefs we know are being impacted by ocean acidification, by temperatures changing. How they're being affected by the global warming, which has associated sea level rise, remains to be seen completely, but we do know that the acidification and the temperatures rising are having a negative impact on the reefs.
And so it's more acidic?
Yeah.
And what's causing that?
Well, the sea level rise or the temperature changes?
The acidification.
Changes in the coastal environment. Exactly what it's attributed to, more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere associated getting into the ocean itself. It's not a simple, there's no simple solution to any of that. But one of the things we're trying to affect in terms of what we can manage on the reef itself is the pressure on the fishing. And that by managing that, that's one of the things we do have some control over. We hope to improve the overall condition of the reefs.
Our number, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. And you can also email radio@wlrn.org. Let's take a call. This is Phil in Davie.
Yes.
Phil, go ahead.
I've fished and dove that area since like the late 1950s on through the 60s while I now currently live up in Broward. But all of a sudden on the navigation charts, areas that were forbidden diving, even using lobsterman look down buckets, was indicated on the charts that was prohibited. I understood later that there were some archaeological sites, shipwrecks and so forth, that were in there that they weren't wanting disturbed. I wondered, what is the status? Is that true? Is anyone undertaking any archaeological excavations in that area?
Hi, Phil. Yeah, that's a very good question. I appreciate that. The Biscayne National Park is home to a wonderful array of maritime history. We've got over 50 shipwrecks within the park, and six of those are designated as part of our Maritime Heritage Trail. And we encourage the public to actually go out and dive and snorkel on those wrecks. There's mooring balls that are maintained on six of those sites so that people can go out and experience that and see what
those
shipwrecks
are. How far back do those wrecks go?
Long ways.
1800s?
Early 1800s. Hmm. And the specific area I think you're referring to is known as the Lagar Anchorage. And that's the one area in the park that is closed for sensitive cultural resource reasons. There are some shipwrecks within that zone that actually don't belong to the United States. They're shipwrecks that were one's a British warship. And with Admiralty law, any kind of warship is maintained. The ownership of that is maintained by the country that it was under, the flag of which it was under.
So England maintains that?
We maintain a cooperative agreement with England to manage that resource. Hmm. Fascinating stuff.
We're speaking with Brian Carlstrom. He's the superintendent of Biscayne National Park on today's Topical Currents. We need to take a short break and we'll be right back. And we're back with today's Topical Currents. Thanks so much for joining us. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Brian Carlstrom, the superintendent of Biscayne National Park. We were talking during the break about this trolley, a free trolley in the city of Homestead. What is this?
Yeah, last year, or earlier this year, the city of Homestead declared itself a gateway community for both Biscayne and Everglades National Parks. And the city council is taking that to heart and has approved a free trolley route that's going to start up in January on the weekends that will allow people to get access to the parks for free. They'll be able to ride out to the Anahinga Trail and Royal Palm and Everglades National Park, and it'll come out to Convoy Point, the visitor center at Biscayne. And we're catering some of our programming at Biscayne on the weekends to the timing of that trolley route.
Oh, okay. We have an emailer, David. He says, I hear the Park Service is planning on severely limiting recreational boating in the park, but details are vague and funding for the modified access is not available. With this limited information, how are recreational boaters to know if we should approve of Park Service plans? Where can we get specific details of non-anchor areas, number of moorings, et cetera?
Yeah, I believe what that's referring to is the special recreation zone. That's defined within the general management plan in Alternative 6 and 7. It's 14,585 acres. That really won't limit any kind of recreational boating per se. It'll put limits on fishing. That area you'll still be able to traverse. You'll still be able to go through. You'll still be able to boat through. The limitations are going to be placed on that are specifically to fishing. There isn't going to be any grouper harvest allowed. There won't be any lobstering allowed. Spear fishing will be discontinued with the exception of exotic lionfish. No anchoring will be allowed. There'll be mooring buoys put in place within that 14,585 acres for folks to come in and enjoy diving and fishing. And the fishing access is going to be limited through a permit system. And it's going to require an educational component where folks will have to take a little online course in order to be eligible to apply for that permit. And it'll be an annual permit that will be administered both by the Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission and the park.
I suppose the non-anchoring provision is to protect the reefs.
That is exactly correct.
Yeah,
and also the cultural resources that are within that area.
Let's take another phone call. We've got John. John's in Fort Lauderdale. Hi there.
Hi. I was interested in Stiltsville and grew up diving and fishing around the old houses there. And that lies within the park, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Could you explain a little bit what the rules and regs will be concerning those buildings, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Thank you.
Yeah, the Stiltsville is within Biscayne National Park, and it's managed through a cooperative effort with the Stiltsville Trust. The general management plan basically just acknowledges that, and it's the specifics for how we manage Stiltsville is done through a cooperative agreement that we're getting ready to renew next calendar year with Stiltsville. The public can have access to them through the Stiltsville Trust. And any of the specific rules and regulations regarding Stiltsville are managed through that.
Brian Carlstrom, superintendent of Biscayne National Park. It must be difficult to balance all of the shareholders and people who have some views, and some are very vehement about them, but to kind of keep a neutral road where you can balance the environmental impacts versus leisure.
Yeah, that's exactly correct, and that's actually part of the enabling legislation for the entire National Park Service. We were created to preserve and protect for the enjoyment of this and future generations. And it's that balance that makes the challenge of working for the National Park Service so rewarding.
What's the most difficult part of your job?
Balancing? The most difficult part of my job recently, honestly, was during the shutdown.
Right. How did
When
how
I
did
had
that
to tell
affect?
Visitors the park was closed. Because it's their park to enjoy, but because of what was happening up in Washington with that impasse on the budget, we had to close the park. That's not what the park employees are there to do. That's really goes against our being. As Director Jarvis of the Park Service put it, that isn't in our DNA. It goes against what we're about.
Can people volunteer to work
absolutely.
At the park? And what would be some of their duties?
We welcome volunteers. We've got volunteers.
Cleaning up
We've got volunteers doing everything from helping out with actually some of our media stuff to managing our or manning our
media
visitors.
Stuff.
Yeah, what do you mean
you
by
mean like
media
topical
stuff?
Currents?
no, well, they'll help out with some of our layouts for our brochures and flyers and that kind of thing. We've got volunteers that help out with our maintenance. We've got volunteers that help out with our visitor center. We got volunteers that help out with maintenance. Every spring break, you know, South Florida is famous for college kids coming down here. We have hundreds of kids that come to the park for an alternative spring break and help clean up our turtle beaches so that the marine debris that accumulates over the winter is removed.
Instead of partying in Fort Lauderdale.
Well, I'm not going to say they probably do some of that too, but part of their time they spend at the park helping clean up.
And you get information about volunteering at the website, I'm sure.
Yes, you can.
And Gary has written an email. He said if nearly 20,000 people commented the last time in favor of a marine reserve, why is the park kowtowing to special interest groups, including Fish and Wildlife Commission?
We did have nearly 20,000 comments, and the majority of them were in favor of a marine reserve zone. However, the comment process is not a voting process. All the comments are considered equally, and we look at them for substantive comment. The enabling legislation for Biscayne National Park requires us to work and manage the fisheries resources within the park cooperatively with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission. They couldn't support directly going to a marine reserve zone, which was the primary tool for preserving the reefs that was described in the management plan from 2011. They felt we needed to go through an adaptive management strategy first before we could consider going to marine reserve zone.
And could you explain that, put that in other terms?
A special recreation zone is an area within the park that we've defined. There was previously a marine reserve zone. That was going to restrict all access for any kind of fishing. Fishing would not have been allowed within the marine reserve zone. This plan, a new alternative, it's alternative 6 in the document, allows that after, or could allow that after we go through an adaptive management strategy. We're going to be looking at and monitoring the fish populations, the benthic or bottom dwelling communities, that includes the corals, how we've got the mooring buoys placed, how effective the education system is. And as we go through that over a 10-year period, we'll evaluate how it's going at 3, 5, 8, and 10-year increments. At the 5 and 10-year increments, we're going to actually have a panel review the findings that we've gathered from that trial period, as it were, for the special recreation zone through that adaptive management to determine if we're on the right track.
Now, about these fishing special permits, what would that procedure be and how much would they cost? And you said you had to go through an online education program?
We're still working out the details for that, but the concept of it would be there'd be two permits issued and it would be seamlessly for the person applying for it. First thing they'd have to do is apply for, or they would get online and take an educational class to learn about what the program is about. Then it'd apply through a lottery system. It would be issued annually. State of Florida isn't going to charge for it. Park Service is going to have a nominal fee through a special use license process.
Now, if I have a permit and I want to go out on my boat and fish in Biscayne National Park and bring Bonnie, who doesn't have a permit,
that's fine.
Could she fish?
Yes.
As long as the person with the boat
correct
has it.
And the one other thing with the permits, though, we want to gather as much information as we can about the fishing effort that's happening. We want to try and have this be a novel approach to managing a fisheries resource and marine environment. States never tried this before. They're really excited about trying this out. We're hopeful that this can create a special, unique marine environment that actually enhances the fishery for the fishing experience. And each of the permit holders will be required to submit a logbook.
I just want to ask how long this plan is going to take to enact.
We hope to have it completed by the end of 2014. And then the plan itself will outline the management strategy for the park for 20 to 30 years.
Well, we want to thank Brian Carlstrom, the superintendent of Biscayne National Park, for being with us today. That website again is NPS, as in National Park Service, .gov/BISC. And we will have a link to that on our website and on our Facebook page, and that's WLRN.org. Brian, thanks so much for joining us, and best of luck with the plan.
Good to meet you, Brian.
Thank you very much. Good to meet both of you. Thanks for having me.
Food and Dining is next. And we're back. It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Bonnie, Food and Dining Thursday is here. Always one of our favorites. And we're joined by chef, author, and syndicated columnist Linda Gastenheimer. Each year before the holiday season, she tells us about new kitchen gadgets on the market, perhaps for gifts. So, Linda, look at all this stuff.
I know.
What's up for today?
I filled the studio. It's Christmas ahead of time, okay?
Ay, ay, ay.
Oh, good. I'll take that.
Yeah, well, just a moment.
I'll take dibs.
Okay. It's our annual holiday gift gadget program. Even my friends who don't cook love gadgets, as I can see here in the studio.
And they probably wind up in drawers.
Are you saying I don't cook, Linda?
I have no idea.
You're correct.
Okay, I thought I was. Anyway, I thought we could test some of them. And also, we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Do you have any kitchen gadget ideas to share with us? Maybe you've got some duds to tell us about. Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. Do we have email, Bonnie?
We do, radio@WLRN.org.
Also with us is our favorite wine guy, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype. And you can read Fred's wine suggestions for my Dinner in Minutes column. That's in today's Miami Herald. And also, he has a wine column in today's Miami Herald. Mm-hmm.
He's also in Michigan, and I bet he has long johns on.
So, Fred, kitchen wine gadgets in the snow?
Just a minute. I got to adjust my long johns before I can talk here. Yeah, wine gadgets. I love them, and I'm going to talk about them.
All right. We won't ask. I'm not going to ask you for the weather report. Well, let's start with what I'd like to start with is actually just some kitchen helpers is what I'm calling them. And I have here, some of you may have, like pomegranates, okay? I've got this gadget here. Now, I love pomegranates. I don't like the mess and the fuss of seeding them.
And the stains.
And the stains and everything else. But this pomegranate tool will solve your problem. So let me explain. It's a nice gift for the holiday season because it's red.
Oh, that's what that thing is.
It's plastic. It's a bowl. It's a red, little red bowl, and there's a... What would you call this?
Like a colander.
A lid.
It's got huge, it's got big holes in
yeah.
it. So I put that there. I've got a pomegranate here that I cut in half. And I'm putting that seed side down.
Okay.
All right. I've got another piece, a red silicone piece that goes over the upside down.
To keep it from spraying.
Exactly. Now, here's the deal. You take a spoon and you whack it. Like this.
Oh, my.
And the so watch out. Good if you've had a frustrating holiday season.
It's like we have picture pomegranate juice spraying all over the studio.
It's like we have Lizzie
it's
Borden
like a punching
here.
Bag.
And what happens is the pomegranates fall into the base. Now, sometimes you get pith there, but that's okay because you can just take the pith off. That's very easy. I'm not going to continue.
Yeah, please. Yeah.
But you can do this whole, I've seeded a whole pomegranate in less than a minute. And so I really like this gift because I like pomegranates. And you know what? They're great for salads. I put it in cereal. And because they're such colorful little red bees, they make great decorations for your holiday dinners. So that's the call.
Keep that in mind, Bonnie, for your holiday dinner.
Okay.
The pomegranate tool. It's $19.95 is a suggested retail price. You can go online, maybe find another price. Anyway, all of my gadgets that I'm talking about are on my website with a photograph. And what they are, so you'll be able to go find them.
I think we need a video of you smashing that pomegranate.
I'd pay $100 to see that.
Okay, so here's another tool. Now, you asked me earlier, what was this, Joe?
It looks like a small meat grinder.
It looks like the old-fashioned manual. That you used to attach to the corner of your table and everything. And no, this is, it's attached by a suction.
Oh, it looks like a cheese grater.
It is a cheese grater. So, and it has two different kinds of grating tubes to go in it. But, of course, you can grate cheese, you can grate nuts and everything. I love this one because your fingers are not going to get grated when you're grating that cheese or anything else.
That's always helpful.
But what I did was, I wanted to show you that you could shred vegetables. Oh. So I put some carrots in the top, and I just turn it around and around, and out comes the grated carrots. So that's called the cheese grater and grinder. The cheese grinder. And that will be on the website. We're going to tell you it's about, it's $29.95. So that's not too bad, and I think it makes a nice present.
And where do we get these things, online or?
You can get them online. This one you can get through www.fantesfantes.com. The pomegranate is sold at Sur La Table. But again, go online. You can go into my website and see what they are and see what the actual names are, and you can find them wherever.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So now let's go to another one that I love. It's a surprising statistic, okay? Tea is exploding in popularity. People are taking, Bonnie's wriggling her nose. I'm glad I put this product
in front of you. I'm drinking tea right now.
Yes. Okay, good for you, Joe. People are taking a break from coffee and they're drinking tea. But here's another one. Tea is the most popular drink throughout the world. So there you are. Mm-hmm. So for your tea enthusiasts, if you have someone who loves tea, the Smart Kettle, it's by Chef's Choice, and it makes the perfect cup of tea. You've got it in front of you, Bonnie. Do you want to describe it?
Well, it looks like one of those automatic, it has a little burner on it, I guess
it is. It's a little base
electric automatic.
Yeah.
And it looks like a coffee pot, actually. It looks like a stainless steel.
It's a big stainless steel, it boils water. Well, here's something that maybe we didn't realize. That if you want the perfect cup of tea, it depends on the temperature of the water. So this one is a Smart Kettle because it'll brew the tea to the exact temperature. Whether you might have herbal tea, white tea, green tea, black tea. And also, if you want to make hot chocolate, hot cereals, you can even boil water to blanch vegetables. And there's a tea temperature guide that comes with it. And what I thought was really interesting is that you can heat your water faster than you can heat it in the microwave for whatever you're making. And that's Chef's Choice. Now, that's $49.95, a little pricey, but it's a beautiful gift.
Well, it is.
It's a very nice gift, and it works because I've used it.
And is this the tea from it?
No. Don't. You're getting ahead of yourself just a little bit.
Okay,
so now we have the tea, the Tea Forte tea. I'm looking for the... here, this is making iced tea. Now, we love iced tea here. And you can make and serve the iced tea. And it's very... if you look at the picture there of what it is, it's two glass pitchers that are stacked on top of each other. And They're very attractive. It's nice to put on a table if you're going to be serving the tea.
Oh.
Now, what's nice about this is that it's called the Tea Forte Iced Tea Brewing System. And what happens, you pour hot water in the top pitcher that sits on the other pitcher.
Right.
And you steep your tea. And these are very strong tea bags. So then you take that steeped tea and you pour it into the base that's filled with ice, and it immediately makes an iced tea, but it doesn't dilute the flavor. It's a very, so you've got some in front of you. You can taste okay. The tea that you've got there. I've made some iced tea. So I did sweeten a little bit.
Yeah, it's very good.
It's very nice. Mm-hmm. Now, you need it's a very pretty present. If you want to just put it out and display it. But you use these tea bags. Now, these tea bags that come with it are very, they're big, huge triangles. And those are separate. And in fact, if you want to just give a present to a tea lover, these teas are very nice.
Could you just stick some regular tea in there?
Yes, you can, but you need the strength. You need maybe two or three tea bags. Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise the ice will dilute it too much.
Right. So you want
or loose tea.
Loose tea, then you'd need a strainer. Oh. You could do that, sure. You could certainly steep the loose tea, but have a strainer. And that's $39 for a very pretty, I think, attractive
set. Yeah, it is. Set.
All right, so back to coffee.
Okay.
Bonnie, you're all right now. I don't want to leave out our coffee. So if you have cappuccino, lattes, hot chocolate, I've got here this frother. Joe's just sort of looking, oh my goodness.
Oh, you're really banging around stuff. It's like a...
Oh, I want everybody to know that these are actually here in the studio.
It's like professional wrestling.
So here we have, look, this... This gadget makes frothy velvet, warm milk, and
for your cappuccinos or lattes.
Does that have a burner, or do you put it on the stove?
No, it comes. It sits on a base. And the base is electric and plugs into the wall.
I bet you don't drink coffee, and you don't need that.
What do you think she has in mind? Do you think she has something in mind here?
I think she wants maybe. Borrow it for a while.
Maybe.
I don't know about borrowing from Barney.
Okay.
Okay. So what it's called the AeroLatte Hot Milk Frother, and it makes really velvety milk froth in just 2 to 3 minutes. That's all. It's a stainless steel pitcher, and it sits on the electric-coated base, as you mentioned. It heats, and it whisks at the same time. It's got two different whisks in it. One is the whisk that makes it really, really thick, frothy. And then it's got a paddle type if you want less of a foam. And you know what Joe wasn't too happy when he tasted this because it's just...
Well, on its own, it's...
On its own.
Kind of...
But you know what? It gets so thick and frothy. I was thinking maybe put some vanilla in it, some cinnamon and some sugar. That might be a nice little snack. Anyway,
that's right.
You know, I've got one of those for my wife, just a little simple $9 battery-powered whisk. And it does a wonderful job. It froths up the milk for a latte, and you don't have to clean it the way you do in those $300 machines. You just rinse it off.
Okay, this is a $100 machine, and it cleans very quickly. But anyway, it's great if you have somebody who loves coffee and they love cappuccinos. It's a nice little thing.
And who makes that?
That's AeroLatte, A-E-R-O, okay. Latte. And again, it's on the website. All right. Baking is big this season, especially cookies. So, have you ever made a batch of cookies and the cookies run together? Or you're not quite sure, they're both of them shaking their head. I guess they never,
I've made cookies. I don't know about Bonnie. Maybe as a little girl.
Maybe.
Sad look on your face. Okay. This is a cookie pan with drop zones. Now, some of you may know about Cake Boss on television. So these drop zones.
It sounds like military.
Drop zone.
Guys jumping out of helicopters.
Here it is, and it has little circles on the pan already. Can you see them?
Yes.
Okay, good. So this.
And there's 15, 3x5, right?
You counted that already. Good for you. Okay. It takes the guesswork because what it has, it's all measured out. So you drop the exact amount of cookie dough into that area and it bakes and they don't run together.
Perfect.
So it's stamped right into the surface, the guide is. And it has rubberized handles, which I like because it makes it easier to lift it in and out of the oven.
I don't know how I've ever gotten along without that.
Well, if you want an 11 by 17 one, you can have it for $16.95. It's by CakeBossBaking.com. And it's a fun gadget. It's fun if you like to, on the holiday, especially if you're cooking with kids and all. I think that's a nice thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so now, back to baking. Okay, we're still in baking. Have you ever heard of Rosalie?
Well, we're talking about baking. What about breaking?
Oh, it's time to take a break, and I haven't even gotten to half my products here. Oh, my goodness. Okay. Well, I'm Linda Gassenheimer. It's our gadget gift program. We'll take a break, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're talking about my favorite kitchen gadgets. And all of the gadgets that we've mentioned are be listed on my website with photos and prices and even some that we haven't had time to talk about. And our favorite one is, Bonnie, your favorite one is the latte?
The milk frother.
Milk frother. Mine is the pomegranate tool.
Joe?
That's Joe's answer.
No, I'm sure Joe loves the vegetable grinder.
Not unless it can grind pork.
All right. It's dinner in minutes time. Maybe you're looking to undo some of the holiday indulgence you had last week. Here's a quick dinner that won't break your calorie bank. It's a balsamic pork scallopini with zucchini sweet potatoes. So you take tender, juicy pork scallopinis. They only take a few minutes to cook on either side. And the sauce is made with balsamic vinegar. It gives it a tangy and a sweet flavor to the pork. And then I added pine nuts to add a crunchy texture. So this is what you do. You take the pork tenderloin and you cut 1-inch slices off of that and you bang them to about 1/4 inch thick. So take a couple of minutes per side, remove them, and add the vinegar and pine nuts to the skillet. Reduce that, pour it over the pork, and you're done. It's very simple. The sweet potatoes are cut into small pieces. They're boiled for about 5 minutes. Then I add some sliced zucchini to the boiling water and cook that another 5 minutes. Drain and toss with olive oil. It's really simple, don't you think?
Certainly is.
Okay, well, that recipe and a photograph, it's at dinnerinminutes.com. And you can find another quick recipe in today's Miami Herald. It's roasted buttery salmon and an herb sauce with braised asparagus. And please follow me on Twitter. So, Fred Tasker in the frozen north, any wine gadgets?
Oh, I love wine gadgets. I've got a bunch of them. I've been Googling all over and finding some very unusual ones, actually. And my first one this year is actually for beer rather than wine. You know how when you're drinking a beer, it goes flat and it loses its head after a few sips? Well, now you can solve
Bonnie's
that.
Bonnie's kind of wrinkling her head.
I don't know. That's
that
why.
That happens to you all the time, Bonnie?
Yes, I think all the time.
All the time. You can solve that with the Sonic Foamer. It's a little gadget. You set your glass of beer on a little plastic plate and you turn it on and it sends ultrasonic waves up through the beer, recreating the head. It's absolutely genius. And it's only $39.99 at sonicfoamer.com.
Interesting.
Or, getting back to wine, if you're a fan of the Duck Dynasty TV show, you can buy Duck Dynasty wines. There's a white, a rosé, and a red. I'm sure those guys love them. And they're only $10 at Walmart. Now, I haven't tried those, so if you do, let me know how they are, okay? But the most ambitious gadget is the Coravin Wine Access System. That's spelled Coravin. This lets you try a glass of wine from a bottle without taking out the cork. It's a thin tube that you insert through the cork, draw out some wine, and pump in inert argon gas to preserve the rest of the wine. And the inventor says he has tested this for 10 years, and you can actually draw a glass of wine out of a bottle and leave the rest for 10 years, and it will be in perfect shape.
Whoa.
The only problem is $299, and you have to spend $29 for the canisters of argon gas. There are actually a lot more nifty gadgets this year, and I write about them in my wine column today in the Miami Herald. Things like wine for your cat, or a
wine for your what?
Cat.
That'll get me in trouble with Bonnie, won't it?
That's for sure. Well,
this has no alcohol in it. It has vitamin C and gives a whole new meaning to the word catnip. Or you can have a planet-saving wine bottle made out of paper that they say is good for up to 3 hours in an ice bucket.
Paper wine bottle?
Yeah, it's 70% lighter than glass, so it saves the planet, you see.
Okay.
Or there's an electronic system to alert you on your iPhone any place in the country if your kid tries to get into your wine cellar. So you could, if you want to see about these, go buy a copy of the Miami Herald, or better yet, buy a whole bunch of copies and keep us in business.
I bet young Fred did a little of that.
Absolutely. Well, actually, my dad wasn't much into wine. He was into very, very, very cheap Chianti, and that almost put me off wine for the first half of my life.
But you make up for it.
Yeah, I've been working on it ever since. Or you can go to MiamiHerald.com and just type in Fred Tasker Wine into the search box and find my column. So you can make all your wine-loving friends happy.
Okay. Well, back to some of our kitchen gadgets that we were talking about. Joe, in front of you, you've got some ice cube trays. They look rather strange. So what do you think those are?
I guess they would make round ice cubes, kind of like the size of a golf ball.
Exactly. Well, a little less than, maybe a little golf ball. But why would you want to do that? And the reason is that they decided if you have these solid balls of ice, that you only need to use one per glass, because the solid ice melts slower. So you don't need all these ice cubes that are going to dilute your drinks.
You know, I've seen those, and you can also get stainless steel ice cubes so they don't dilute your wine at all, or your drink, or whatever you're having.
There you go. Okay.
Just don't swallow one.
Well, I'm glad to have an ice maker on the fridge.
Well, so that's really an interesting thing. But also, you've got in front of you another gadget here. Now, pop it open. No, oh my goodness, give it to me.
I went the wrong way?
Yes, you went the wrong way on it.
Oh, it's a bowl.
It's a bowl, okay.
It folds down.
And it folds flat if you want to store it. But what is it used for? It's a for double boiler. And it's got thick sides so that it's all of silicone. It fits over the pan.
Oh, I see.
And you can melt chocolate and all of that. That's from Rosalie V. Beerenbaum, who wrote the Cake Bible. But the other thing is
it
folds down, so if you have a... You know, it's hard to store a lot of bowls, but the thing is you can also use it to bake a cake and make a round domed cake.
How about feeding a cat wine in it?
Well, it might be used as that. One never knows where you're going to go with that. Also, you've got in front of you, we have just about a minute left, a bar tool.
And citrus.
It's for a bartender's garnishing tool. It's by Microplane. It's stainless steel, and it's about, well, let's describe it. How would you describe it, Joe?
It's like a little,
let me see.
What is, like, it's just a very small grater.
Like a grater. It looks like is it a zester?
But it's rounded. Yes, it's.
It's a zester. Well, it's about, what?
They call it a citrus bar tool.
Citrus, yeah. It's about 10 inches long and about 5 inches wide, or 3 inches wide, would you say? And at one end of it, you can open it, use it to open bottles. There's a grater there, so you could grate citrus fruits. And there's another part of it where you can create professional style garnishes, delicate peels, and it's all in one compact tool. So it's a fun little home bar gift, and it's by Microplane, and it's $19.95. So
I don't think I'd pay that for that.
Well, not mincing words.
All right. So,
clever.
Are we out of time?
Yes.
We are out of time. Well, all of these gadgets are on my website, dinnerinminutes.com. Scroll to the blog area. Fred Tasker, great advice as always.
Always a pleasure.
Nice to be with you, Joseph.
Do you have the
Bonnie.
Fireplace
Thank
going,
you.
Fred?
Yes, on high.
Yes, on high. Stay warm, Fred.
It's going to be 17 degrees tomorrow.
Well, I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and join me next week. We'll have more food.
We have some special programming going on next week.
Yes.
Right? You and Bonnie and I.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to ask everyone to call in.
Mm-hmm.
and chat with us. I'm Linda Gassenheimer.
And then more, something more.
Oh, I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And thanks for lending an ear today. Our producer is Richard Ives. Technical direction from online producer, assistant producer, Paul Leary. You can find free audio archives of this and past programs at our website. That's WLRN.org. More information as well at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow at 1, it's Ed Bell and the South Florida Arts Beat. We return Monday with a program with journalist Sam Friedman, who's chronicled the athletic and social importance of the 1967 Orange Blossom Classic between Florida A&M and Grambling at the Orange Bowl. To the calendar, on this day in 1791, 220 years ago, the death of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart in Vienna, age 35. His enormous output includes pinnacles of symphonic, chamber piano, operatic, and choral music. And on this day in 1839, 174 years ago, the birth of General George Armstrong Custer in New Rumbly, Ohio. He was defeated and killed, of course, at Little Bighorn by a coalition led by Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse. One more while we ponder bathtub gin and homebrew. On this day in 1933, 80 years ago, U.S. prohibition is repealed as Utah became the 36th state to ratify the 21st Amendment. Utah, who'd have thunk it? So we leave with a thought from Custer, who also lost two brothers at Little Bighorn. He was graduated last in his West Point class. Quote, "There are not enough Indians in the world to defeat the 7th Cavalry." Today's recipe at dinnerinminutes.com. Stay with us. Here and Now is next from NPR News.